thank you very much. And once again, thank you to Siphons, to Steve Roth, to Reem for arranging this. This is the third in our three-part series. Classes and lunch and learns go on in general through the year. If anyone is interested, they're also at Miller Bernstein as well as Schwartz, Levitsky, Feldman. So if you're not already on our email list, there's sign-in sheets are around on. There is one at this table, one at this table. And if you ask to be on the weekly email list, then you get notification for all of them. And I do plan, as usual, to send out afterwards to send out a link to the uploaded audio from today, as well as follow up on any questions that come up. So again, make sure that you sign in, and then you'll be able to get the follow up. Topic for today is employee injury, as you see on the title, from carpal tunnel to ransomware. So, in order to address this, we have to ask a basic question, which is, what is the relationship between employer and employee? Does the employer have any sort of special responsibility towards an employee beyond the responsibility you have to any other human being? We have a concept in law called duty of care, which says that there are certain relationships which create a responsibility of one party to another. So most obviously, a parent has responsibilities to a child. A teacher has responsibilities to a student. And the concept of duty of care is such that even where the general law will say so-and-so doesn't owe somebody else anything, in this relationship you do owe them something, and in particular, as it relates here, you have to try to protect them from harm in an active way. That's the concept of duty of care. If you're a doctor and someone is your patient, so you have greater responsibility for that patient than you would to a random person out there on the street. So, potentially, that's actually more to discuss regarding doctors. But does an employer have a duty of care to an employee? That's my opening question. I'll ask you, what do you think? By taking on somebody, by hiring someone to do a job for you, are you accepting upon yourself a responsibility to look after that person?
On the hours he works. For the time he works. Not afterwards.
So one possible formulation is to say, during the period of time when that person is in your employ, when they're actually working for you, you do have some kind of responsibility. What if they're not on your premises? They're working for you, but they're working from home. Do you have a responsibility then? Yeah? So in other words, if I hire somebody to, I don't know, I hire a telemarketer, right? And the telemarketer is going to make phone calls from home. And while at home, they trip on the steps because there was something left on the steps. Do I have a responsibility for that? I don't control the environment at all. So that we have to discuss different types of employment. Right. There's a difference between, just as you know, within law, we distinguish between an independent contractor, right, and someone who is an employee. Maybe from a Jewish law perspective, we have to make that sort of distinction and say you have different responsibilities. Maybe it matters in terms of what the venue is. Are they in their home? Are they wherever they choose to be? Are they, in fact, in a facility that I provide and I control?
Or traveling,
right. Imagine a third scenario. They are my employee, however, they're on the road. And then something happens. Let's say there's a courier. I hire the courier to do a job for me, and something happens to him en route. I happen to send him to, Bangladesh. And something happens to him, on the way. Do I bear responsibility for that? So this is a major question, and really this is what's going to underlie the entire discussion of an employer's responsibility for damage done to an employee. And I tried to pick cases that are a little more contemporary and different, as opposed to sort of the standard discussions. And the two cases that I want to look at are a case in which an office worker is working with furniture that I provided and develops carpal tunnel. That's one issue. And then the second issue, the case in which the company provides a USB and the employee inserts the USB into his laptop, it's his own, and receive some kind of a virus from it, ransomware, virus, malware, whatever you want it to be. And what will be the extent of the employer's responsibility? Take a look, please, at source number one. Source number one introduces us to the issue via a summary of the facts from a major case from 2001. Hunt v. Sutton Group Incentive Realty. On December 16, 1994, this is one particular write-up from the facts. You can find this case. If you Google Hunt v. Sutton, you'll find this all over the place. You can find various summaries online, but I felt this was a good one. On December 16, 1994, Ms. Hunt attended an office party held on the premises of her employer, Sutton Group Incentive Realty, Inc. The party started at around 1 p.m. and ended at 6:30 p.m., which I don't know what they were doing for 5.5 hours, but that was their party. I know what Ms. Hunt was doing. During the party, the employer's business activities continued without interruption. So I guess they're having phone calls, clients may be coming in, something is happening on the business end of things during this. And while participating in the festivities, Ms. Hunt attended her usual duties as telephone receptionist and was expected to clean up the premises after the party. So she is answering phones and also looking after whatever's going on at the party. Around 4 o'clock, a representative of the employer, noting that Ms. Hunt was inebriated, so she was doing something else besides answering phones, suggested that she phone her husband to come and take her home. Thereafter, the representative kept an eye on her until she left the office. So we've established that the employer is aware. We've also established that she was functioning as an employee. She was not a guest at a party. She was working as a receptionist while participating in the party. And I think that, from a secular law perspective, that's relevant. Around 6:30 p.m., Ms. Hunt left her employer's premises with some co-workers and went on to another bar, less than a kilometer away. Around 9:45 p.m., Ms. Hunt was involved in a car accident 12.2 kilometers from the bar. She suffered multiple fractures and severe brain injury, some of which was permanent. Employer responsible?
No.
Anybody want to say yes?
Yes.
There we go.
I can tell you the reasons why.
If you're at a bar drinking, or they're feeding you liquor,
yeah,
you go after it. Have an accident, very often you'll stop at a bar.
That's not what happened here. That's not what happened there.
Right. So you're saying that they are liable for letting her go unescorted? Yeah.
Number of reasons. Number one, the employer did what was necessary. They told her to have your husband pick you up. They told her to not go into a vehicle. They had someone watching over her while she was at that. Number one, when she left, it was her responsibility, because she was already warned not to go. And second of all, the accident happened after drinking another 3 hours. Once she went into the second residence, into the bar, the responsibility then was the bar. The bar should never have let her drive.
Oh, don't worry, the bar's going to get sued too.
Right. I said, she was fine when she got to the bar.
Yeah.
She spent another 3 hours in the bar. That's the responsibility of the bar. They should never let her go out. The responsibility left the employer once she left the employer.
So we have two sides here. We have the side saying they are responsible. We have the side saying that they're not responsible. They did what they had to do. And the answer of the court was they are responsible. The court held them responsible. There was an appeal, surprise, on separate grounds. The employer was responsible. The employer was held responsible because they felt that since they were aware, the court felt that since the employer was aware of her condition, they were indeed responsible to make sure that she went home with a with some kind of safe service. That was the.
And in the long later, she's stunning, and we have to go someplace else.
Then they've done, no, because then they really have done what they could do. Because she was, no one phoned her husband. They told her, you should call your husband. Telling someone who's drunk, go call your husband, doesn't really count. This is Canadian. This is a Canadian case, yeah.
She drove to the bar. Responsibility for each party? Were they given certain responsibility for the bar?
I believe so. I believe it was shared. It wasn't solely on.
Really, all the cases are shared in those situations. Oh,
yeah. She obviously drove from the bar into her accident. Did she drive from the place of
right, so I was trying to figure that out. I couldn't tell from the summaries of the facts that I read how she got to the bar. Was she the driver at that
point? New York City.
It wasn't New York City, though. No, this is a Canadian case. This is a Canadian case. Yeah. This is a Canadian, Ontario employer, yeah.
So she may have had an escort.
All right. So what we're going to do here is not so much to dissect. We're not going to spend that much time dissecting Hunt v. Sutton, as entertaining as it is. But you can find this online. It's all over the place. The appeal was on side grounds of whether the court had adequately determined that she was drunk when she was there versus the drinking she did afterwards. I don't remember after the trail of appeals. I only went through one level of appeals. For all I know, they're still litigating this. The court did believe that given the circumstances that are in source number one, that the employer is liable, suggesting that the employer has a duty of care. It's not the same thing as if I was in a bar, not as an owner or a worker, but just I'm just sitting in a bar and there's somebody else in the bar and I see that they are drinking. And then I see that they pull out their car keys. It could be that as a good human being, I should try to do something. It could be that Judaism will require me to do something. Don't stand by while your brother's blood is shed, and so on. But from a secular law perspective, there's no duty of care. I don't have to do a thing to help this other person. That's not so for the employer. The employer is responsible because they are in a special relationship. So what we're going to have to do is look at this in terms of Jewish law. So let's move into the carpal tunnel discussion. From a secular law perspective in Ontario, the employer is responsible to take precautions under the Workplace Safety and Insurance Act to make sure that the employees will have properly designed furniture and a properly designed workspace so that they will not be vulnerable to predictable accident. If you take a look at source number two, this comes from Ontario's Office of the Employer Advisor. As an employer, it is not only in your best interest to maintain a healthy and safe workplace and to prevent workplace injuries and occupational diseases, it is also your legal obligation under the OHSA. And then they go into detail. How the Workplace Safety and Insurance Board defines accident. According to the Workplace Safety and Insurance Act, accidents include a chance event caused by a physical or natural incident, i.e. falling off a ladder or frostbite, a willful and intentional act, but not an act of the worker, i.e. being assaulted by a coworker. That would be also an accident that you have to try to prevent. And a disablement, which may be a condition that has emerged gradually over time and cannot be attributed to a clearly defined time or place, i.e. carpal tunnel syndrome, or is an unexpected result of the worker's duties, wherein an accident that was originally believed to be minor resulted in disablement at a later date, back injury from bending over to pick up equipment, and so on. So it is explicit here that the employer would be liable for having a workplace in which the carpal tunnel developed as a product of negligence on the part of the employer. This is another aspect of the employer's duty of care. They are supposed to be the ones to proactively ensure that the workspace is safe. So if I am working, and in fact I think that the furniture is ergonomically poor, and I don't say anything, the employer is still going to be responsible for whatever happens to me. Because they had a duty to make sure that everything was okay. I'm not sure how far they have to go in that regard. In other words, let's say they conduct an inspection and they question the employee, and the employee says, no, everything is fine. I mean, it depends who did the inspection, and it depends on what the results of the inspection were. But I just wonder at what point the employee can be considered to be contributory here.
We were trying to get this place pretty right.
Yeah, I mean, in general, you want things in writing. That's true. So, within Jewish law, what will we say? So you have to look at the relationship between employer and employee in Jewish law in general. There are two different models. There's a third model that we'll get to, but there are two basic models. One model is the model of trust. An employer and employee have a mutual agreement of equals that they're going to work together. Any harm that happens to the employee is like harm in general that is inflicted by a proprietor on an individual that's been invited into his space. In other words, I invited the person in, the person trusted me, is now vulnerable to whatever I do. If I hurt them, I am liable for actively hurting them. That's what we call in Hebrew, what we call nezek, harm. That's one model. There's no duty of care. We're two equals who happen to be here, and he trusted me and came into my space and got hurt. The second model is the duty of care model, in which we say the employer is essentially renting the employee, right? You're paying him for his time effort. The employer, as part of rental, agrees to care for the employee. And in the event that harm comes to the employee, then that demonstrates a lack of care by the employer. So one relationship is simply we're two people who are trusting of each other, and the employer should not harm the employee, just as the employee should not harm the employer. The other way to look at it is this, in fact, duty of care responsibility, and there are practical distinctions between them. If I, for example, if I were to view it as model one, that it's simply a relationship of trust between the parties, then liability is only for directly administered harm, not for negligence. In other words, if the employer walks up to the employee and smacks him on the back and wounds him, then the employer is going to be liable. But if the if something happens to the employee without it being a direct action from the employer, and we'll see some examples of it, then no, the employer is not going to be responsible. Whereas if it's duty of care, then you actually have a proactive obligation to look out for the welfare of the employee. So let's take a look at a passage from the Talmud which will tell us how we view this. Source number three. It's dealing with a case of a porter, right? Somebody who, you know, for his job, carries heavy objects or carries heavy loads. So Tanu Rabbanan, our sages taught, Kav Lekataf. A kav is the volume for a porter. What it's talking about, and it's a longer piece, I only brought the part that's directly relevant for us, is that in the event that there is a standard size burden, right? Now, there are rules for what is considered the normal amount that a person will carry, right? I'm more familiar with it in the U.S., but I assume it exists here as well, where if a package is more than a certain size, it will actually have instructions on it to have two people lift it. So this is not new. This existed in Talmudic times. There was a standard measure for what an individual would carry. And if I added a kav is a volume measure, if I added a kav to the package, then I am liable for giving him too much to carry. And as is discussed there, it appears that the kav is not a strict measure. The point is that it's 1/30th of the size of the normal burden. If you go 1/30th above the standard burden that people carry, then as an employer, you're going to be liable. So that's the initial statement here in the Talmud, but which they then challenge. And they ask, I don't understand. Im Isa delo matzi bay, gardasu lishdiye. I don't understand. If this fellow, the porter, can't carry it, he's an intelligent human being. Let him throw it down. When he feels that it's too heavy, let him drop it. So, Amar Abaye. Abaye answers, the first of three answers, B'shechav tola alter. He says, you're right. However, the employer is going to be liable where the load knocks the guy down immediately. He had no opportunity. You put this on his back, and it crushes him. So in that case, he had no way out, and therefore you're liable. That's one way to look at it. Rava gives me a second answer. Rava says, no, there is no liability. There's no liability for loading him up extra. Rather, he explains, what they're talking about here is the issue of charging more. This whole discussion about overloading him isn't about liability for harm done. The question is he able to come back to the boss and say, that wasn't what I contracted to do? You told me you wanted me to carry normal loads, and you gave me something that's larger, therefore I want to be paid more. That's Rava's answer. So he discounts the whole thing. And then Rav Ashi is the third approach. And Rav Ashi says, no. Who suffer chulsha who did not get laid? Rav Ashi says, the porter thinks that he's just become weak. In other words, when you put the oversized burden on him, he doesn't think that it's oversized. That's why he doesn't throw it down. He thinks, yeah, I must be off today, but I'll be fine. And therefore he continues to carry it, and when he is hurt, you are liable. So you see the different models here? Abaye, I'm going to discount Rava, because we don't follow him, and because he takes this in an entirely different direction. But Abaye versus Rav Ashi. Abaye says, the employer is only liable where the harm took place immediately. But otherwise, the employer is not liable. Whereas Rav Ashi says, the employer is liable no matter what. Because the porter didn't realize what was going on. You follow? Now we'll try to explain how it's relevant here. But the Rambam, in source number 4, says we follow Rav Ashi. You look at the case as he presents it. He says, I'll just read it in the English. He says, if one added a kav to a porter's burden, and he was hurt by the burden, the porter was hurt, one must pay for his damage. Although he is intelligent and he senses the weight of the burden, he thinks the weight may be due to his illness. He thinks there's just something wrong with him. That's the Rambam's ruling. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, brings it as well. Side note, I brought you in source number 5 from Yeshua Falk, the Meir HaSeinayim, on the Shulchan Aruch. He says, just as in the passage in the Talmud, I only brought you the porter case, but they mention others as well. The rule is that for each type of career, in each situation, it's a different measure. The same thing will be true today. You don't assume that the weights that they're working with in Talmudic times are necessarily the same for across all businesses and across all generations and all environments. It's not so. It's going to change wherever you are. This is a side note, but I think worth recognizing. But what's the logic in holding the boss liable in the case of the porter? Why are we holding the boss liable?
Because he deliberately overloaded him.
He deliberately overloaded him. Let's say it wasn't deliberate. Let's say it was an accident.
Still didn't take it. The care.
So you're going to look at it as duty of care. Yeah. That's one way to look at it. You could look at it as duty of care. How else could you look at it? The other option is mazik, that you actually are actively harming the guy. But if you're actively harming the guy, if that's true that you're liable because you're actively harming him, then that's going to lead to some questions. It fits much better in a duty of care framework. We're going to come back to this in a second. Yes?
What if he informs the tenor and he takes it? Is it a responsibility then?
Sorry?
If he informs him it's 1/3 of
that year. Right.
Does he have any responsibility?
Good question. What if you told him? You said, yeah, this is over. Do you mind? And he said, nah, I'm good with that. Right. So do you carry any responsibility? So we're going to come to that also. So the take a look, please.
Is the assumption, that the porter is the full-time employee of this particular employer? Like, you didn't call FedEx and give the guy an overly heavy burden.
Right.
Maybe FedEx would be responsible for
that. Right, so that raises a whole other raft of complications they're very good questions, but you're right, that would require its own discussion. The question of liability when somebody is actually, hired through an agency. And is the agency taking responsibility, or is the one who's actually giving him the work responsible? It's a good question, but I'm not prepared for it here. If you take a look at this top of the second side.
There's another aspect.
Yeah.
That is that if you're working with me, I say, take this to the warehouse, and say, no, it's too heavy. He might say, well, what kind of employee are you? And it was a job, whereas if it's just the transaction that you were alluding to,
well, there could be.
Well,
I mean, he works for FedEx, and FedEx gets a complaint.
Right. But in terms of the company, if he knows that the hiring the FedEx will back him up, he's not concerned about this one job, whereas when it's his employer who says,
Right, it's an interesting point. I'm going to come back to something that I think answers that as well. But take a look at the top of the second side, please, where you find Rabbi Moses Nachmanides Ramban, who says, I don't understand how this passage works, why I'm going to hold the employer responsible, according to Rav Ashi. He says, Tmihani, he says, I'm shocked. Is the employer a guardian of the employee's body such that he should pay him? Do you really view the employer as a guardian, which is the duty of care principle? He says, I don't believe that's true. And if you'll say it's a direct act of harm, the other model, that it's actually just a trust relationship and you are harming him, he says, that doesn't make any sense because the harm didn't come from the employer's act. Even if he loads the employee directly, fundamentally it's not as though he smashed the guy down. It's this fellow walking along carrying something heavy that did it. So it's not a direct result and therefore he shouldn't be financially liable. So Ramban struggles with this.
But for the fact that he's employed by the employer. So I don't
understand. Right. So that requires one more piece of information, which we've discussed on occasion before, and that is the principle of grumma. The principle of grumma is essentially indirect harm. If I cause damage to somebody, but it's not my direct action that does it, it's only indirect, then I often am prohibited from doing that, but I'm not liable for the damage that results. If I, sorry?
The fire starts off.
Well, there maybe we're going to come back to the fire, so don't go to the fire just yet. But the argument Ramban is giving is, if I did something that led to his harm, I shouldn't have done it. But since it wasn't as though I slammed this down on him and crushed him, like Abaye's case, fundamentally I shouldn't be liable to pay for it. That's the argument that he wants to bring under the grumma principles. We're going to come back to it because we have to talk more about grumma in order to go through some of the other elements here. But that's Ramban's statement. He says you're not a guardian. He says Ramban is saying there is no duty of care, and if you're going to hold me liable for damages because you're going to say I hurt him, I didn't. I caused it. Maybe that wasn't good. And but fundamentally, I wasn't the one who inflicted the harm.
If you tell him the extra weight, mm-hmm. and he says I'm good with it if you add 10% to my wages.
Yeah.
Is your liability eliminated at that point, even if he's injured by it?
Right. So that again goes back to the question of what if he says I'm okay with this? It's the same question, just that you've added in that you're being compensated. But it's the same fundamental question. So I'm still not ready for it. I will be, but not yet. So that is the question that he's fundamentally asking, that Ramban is asking here. If I take the model of duty of care, Ramban isn't happy with me, but it's very clear that's what Rav Ashi believes. Rav Ashi, despite Ramban's objection, believes that yes, an employer has a duty of care, has to look out for the employee, and that's why one is liable. Model number two, the model of violating the employee's trust. Not that you have to care for him, but that he trusted you when he walked in and now you did something that harmed him, will fit with Abaye. Abaye says you're liable if you slam it down on his shoulder and it crushes him. That's when you're liable. So he takes that kind of view. However, you could also suggest that maybe Rav Ashi agrees as well to the model of you harmed him. You could use that. Even though we just said there was no direct harm. And the reason why is because of a comment made by Ritva in source number 7, which is very important for some of the questions that are being asked here regarding the employee agreeing to it. Ritva, Rabbeinu Yom Tov of Seville, says the following. He says, you might ask, he, the porter, fooled himself. So why should the employer be liable? What did the employer do wrong? The employer gave him a burden. The employee, as is presented talmudically, the employee said, you know, this is really heavy. I must be weak today. Instead of saying, this is really heavy, this must be over the standard limit. So when when he says that, he's fooling himself. Why is the employer liable? Say, Ritva continues to explain, perhaps it is because the employer caused the error. For the employee trusted him to tell the truth. And that is the key. When you hire somebody, certainly in our environment, but even in theirs apparently, but in our very legal environment where you have workplace safety acts, and there are all sorts of rules, the person who comes in to do the job assumes that the facility is going to follow all of the rules. And if this is what is given to him, it must be safe. It must be in compliance. Since he was harmed due to the word of the employer and his authority, this is the employer's arrow, so to speak. It's as though the employer shot an arrow that hit him. And we're going to say, indeed, that the employer will be liable. Like when one shows a dinar to a money changer and he says it is good. We talked about this a couple of years ago, right? You have a coin. You bring the coin to the money changer and say, someone wants to pay me with this. You're an expert. Is this coin legal tender? He looks at it, bites it, whatever he does, and says, yes, this is legal tender. You accept the coin on his say-so. Then when you want to go spend it, you find out that it's counterfeit. It's deficient in some way. You're able to go back to him and say, that's malpractice. You gave me bad advice. You were functioning in your capacity as a professional. You are now going to have to make it up to me. But it was only indirect. That was Grumma. His really, he only indirectly caused me harm. Nonetheless, it's direct enough that he will be held liable. That's the malpractice money changer case. And the same thing is true over here, argues Ritva in number 7. He says, even if there is no duty of care, let's do away with the duty of care model and say instead that it's based on violation of trust. Nonetheless, since the employer is since the employer has the trust of the employee, if he gives him something that doesn't fit, that everybody knew the employee was going to trust him on, he's going to be liable. So the upshot of this is you can adopt either model to explain the liability here and either say, yes, there is a duty of care, or you could say, there's no duty of care, but there is trust between them, and if you violate that trust, you will be liable for having done so. Either one is going to work. The difference between them will be the case of Sutton and Hunt. Because it's one thing to say, if I have a duty of care, then it's all over. If the employer has a duty of care, then Sutton is liable for what happened with Hunt. However, if we'll say it's about trust, the question is, what does an employee have a legitimate right to expect of the employer? Does the employee have a legitimate right to expect that just because they know each other and they're functioning together, I think that they're going to stop me from driving drunk? I think that's a reach. I think it only works if you accept duty of care. It doesn't work if your model is simply that they're two trusting people, you know, one of whom has been invited into the other one's workplace.
What is the violation of trust that Rick was talking about?
Because the employer is trusted to provide you a proper burden, and instead they provided you an oversized burden without telling you.
Without telling you.
Correct. Well, if they informed them, well, that's where I'm going with this. Now, you ask the question of, what if the guy says, I'm good with this burden? So at that point, there's no violation of trust. And therefore, under the trust model, there's nothing to discuss. And potentially, even under the duty of care model, there's nothing to discuss. I think even under the duty of care, we could construe that as a legitimate statement of, I did what I could. I informed him. I let him know. He chose to take the job. That was his decision. You could make that argument. In fact, both models seem to be accepted. There are nuances of difference between how you would apply them, but both models seem to be accepted within Jewish law. Trying to figure out if I want to go this route with it or not to prove it. Very quickly, there are two different types of liability in Jewish law when it comes to harming somebody. If I, as a person, as a human being, lash out at another human being and harm them, I am liable for 5 different types of damage. Nezek, tzar, ripui, sheves, and voshes. Nezek is the person's physical depreciation. What is that person worth? If they were to be sold on the slave market, what's their reduced value? Their pain, their medical bills, their time lost from work, and any humiliation that occurred. All of those are my responsibility. However, if it's not that kind of a direct case where I struck somebody else, any other type of harm, you just pay for what's called nezek, basic depreciation to the person, and you don't pay for the others. That's going to be a difference here. If I take this as a case of duty of care, I should have been more careful, and I wasn't more careful for them, then I just pay nezek. But if I take it as mazik, I actually harmed him, we view it like I slugged him, in that case I'm going to have to pay for all 5. So take a look, please, at source number 8, Rabbi Moshe HaKohen, an early authority. I couldn't get exactly when he lived, so I didn't put in biographical detail. But he's quoted in the Torah. He says, logically, I believe he lived in the city of Lunel in France. He says, logically, he, the employer, should only pay for depreciation. He would only be liable for the other 4 payments where he harmed directly. He's saying that really we view this not as direct harm. We really view this as duty of care. That's the way that we look at it. Now, I think there are some quirks here. For example, the fact that in the carpal tunnel case, as opposed to the Porter case, the employer isn't increasing the guy's work. He's just giving him bad furniture. You know, in the Porter case, I actually gave him more of a load to carry. He's actively working for me with this extra bit of the load. But nonetheless, what emerges from this is the boss is liable, either because he wasn't adequately careful or because he actively is considered to have caused harm.
So an employer has to provide an OBIS form or specified care for each employee?
Based on whatever is the standard for care. Whatever is considered to be the standard for care. Now, mind you, I think you have to work with whatever the secular authorities establish as the standard of care. I don't think a Beit Din is going to sit down and evaluate. But you may have to consider, what if this employee has a back problem? And I hire them, am I now responsible to provide whatever this employee in particular needs?
Yeah. I'm just wondering, the Hunt case that you cite, is the fact that there was a party where the secretary partook, and so the employer caused her drunkenness in part, right? Like, I mean, she went to a bar as well, but, you can't delineate what part of the alcohol was consumed that caused the car accident, so therefore the employer had a situation where she got drunk, and also the bar. So that had an impact on the liability of the employer, as opposed to, let's say, the employee happens to be a drunk and just drinks on the job, but the employer was not furnishing the employee with alcohol and then says, we want you home, so to speak, and stuff
so
like
a,
that.
Right. So I think that's a really good distinction. This is the last question I can take on this case, because I still want to see the ransomware discussion. But but I think that's actually a good way to distinguish between Model 1 and Model 2. If I were to take it as there's a relationship of trust and you violated the trust with this employee by overloading him or by giving her the alcohol, then if she drinks on her own, you didn't harm her. However, if the issue is duty of care, so I have a responsibility to look after my employees, it doesn't matter why she was drinking or where she got the alcohol. Fundamentally, I can't let them get in a car, leaving my facility when I know that they're not able to drive properly. So I think that will be a distinction between the two models. And my sense is that we do go with a duty of care approach, and therefore you would be responsible even if the alcohol didn't come from the business. I'm not sure what secular law would say. I think that's an open question. I'm going to hold other questions on this topic just because I want to make sure to do the ransomware discussion. Take a look at this other section here that starts with number 9. Ransomware, in case anyone is not familiar, is software which is malicious software which can lock up your computer. And generally speaking, what it's designed to do is it locks your computer, it warns you that your files will all be destroyed unless you wire a certain amount of money to whatever account, and so on. And it's very real, and it's not just in the movies. Like, it happens to people quite frequently. And so the question is, what if I manage to contract ransomware from the company's network, and it's on my computer at home now, and I'm going to have to pay this ransom? Or to what extent does the employee turn to the employer and say, pay me for the harm caused? So it's interesting. In Canadian law, I have not found anything yet dealing with viruses and so forth. In the U.S., there are many, many articles on this issue. I gave you 3 links in source number 9. They're not the only ones, but they're 3 particularly interesting articles. Civil Remedies for the Victims of Computer Viruses, The Tort of Negligent Enablement of Cybercrime. They need a better name for it. That doesn't roll off the tongue. And The Legislative Response to the Evolution of Computer Viruses. But it's a very live issue, and it's going on. So the question really is, so what will be the extent of the responsibility? So as a general rule within Jewish law, an employer is not responsible for harm which occurs to an employee's property as a result of doing his job. So if you look at source number 10, if a person's property is damaged because of a task he performed for someone, or because they accused him due to his task and cost him money. In other words, you go to work for somebody, someone else doesn't like him, and decides, I'm going to sabotage him by going to the local authorities and telling them something about his employee. And so the result is that the employee gets hurt because he was working for this employer. The sender, the person who sent him on his mission, is not obligated to pay his damages. Where the harm happened because you're working for him, he is not liable. However, that's different from our case. Why? Why is that different from our case? Because in that case, sorry? Well, not that there's no shlichus. In that case, the harm is tangential to the job. What we're talking about is where the harm occurred because I was doing my job. In other words, it isn't that something happened to me because I worked for so-and-so. It's that so-and-so effectively hurt me. My employer hurt me. My employer had a network. It was an unsecured network. They didn't properly, install the proper antivirus software, whatever it was. And because of that, the employer was the one who harmed me. The company caused the harm. So I don't think that source number 10 really applies here. Rather, what we have to look at is the question of how we view computer viruses in Jewish law. There's a volume of the Talmud called Bava Kamma, which in the beginning defines various categories of harm and their key characteristics. What defines something as being in one category or another depends on things like intent. Is it a mobile harm or is it a static harm? All sorts of related questions. So there's one particular category of harm called Aish. Aish means fire. And what defines Aish, what defines fire as a form of harm and what gives it then its parallels is, fire is a harmful entity that you create within your own property, but it has the capacity to spread as long as it finds fuel in order to do so. Well, two things. It needs fuel, and it needs something that's going to propel it. Right? The wind is what's going to normally propel the fire. So Rabbi Shlomo Dechavsky wrote an article in the journal Tchumen, in volume 22, in which he argued that a virus is like Aish. A virus is like fire. It is a harmful entity that's living on your property, on your computer, and then it goes out to harm others, and it has fuel, so to speak, and has the wind via the intercomputer connections, via the internet or an intranet, it doesn't make a difference. And he says one is liable if he has fire on his property and the fire spreads in a predictable way. Right? There's a lot of discussion about what if it spreads in an unpredictable way, but in this case it's very predictable. So so based on the passage, it's the Talmud and Bava Kamma, Chafbet Amad Aleph 22a, they have a discussion there as to one's liability for the spread of fire. And it offers two different ways to look at it. One way to look at it is that fire is like an arrow that you shoot. I set a fire, it's like I shot an arrow. The other way to look at it is that fire is like my property. And therefore, if it goes out and causes harm, I'm not liable because I didn't propel it. It was propelled. But the way we rule, as I brought you from Rambam, from Maimonides in source number 11, is that one is liable where fire spreads from his property and even where I'm not the one who kindled it. The commentary, Hagos Mamonios, on source number 11, says I'm liable even if I wasn't the one who kindled the flame. So Rabbi Dachovsky says, therefore, one who has a computer with a virus on it will be liable for anybody else who gets the virus from him. He has a side note, which is also fascinating, which is that really, they're not getting your virus. The virus is replicating. They're getting their own virus, so to speak. But in source number 12, I quoted from his article, which there's a Hebrew and an English version online for his article. I gave you two links in source number 12. The first link is the Hebrew. The second link is the English translation. And he says, any virus that's born of this is simply, as he calls it, property born of property. They're all created by the impetus of the first virus. Theoretically, if you can go back to the person who actually created it, you can hold him liable. Good luck.
It seems in 11, Rambam, to say an individual who kindled it. What if a fire was caused by lightning? He didn't even know the fire happened on his property. It wasn't even kindled.
Right. So if you didn't know it was there, there's no liability in the lightning case. However, the question is, what's your standard of responsibility? In other words, I may not need in general, there's no rain, there's no storm, I don't need to worry about lightning striking my property. However, perhaps, if there's a big lightning storm and everybody can see that's actually local, maybe I do have a responsibility to go out and check and see at some point, is there fire on my property? And if I don't, and days go by, and then it spreads, maybe I do have responsibility.
But this is my point.
Yeah.
In the case of the virus, nobody contracts a virus intentionally.
Right.
And they may not even know they have a virus for a week.
Right.
During which time, the lightning has spread the fire all over the place.
Right. Which is what brings me to the question of applying this to a work situation. If we take the model of duty of care, that an employer has a duty of care to an employee, then just like the argument earlier from the Ritva, who said that the boss has a responsibility to, if we say that there's a duty of care, the boss is liable because providing a worker with something implies that it is safe. And therefore, yes, he was supposed to have checked. It was within his duty of care that he should do so. So based on that, the argument will be the boss is going to be liable, whether under duty of care or even under trust, because he'll say, well, he trusted him to provide him something that wouldn't infect him. I will note, though, Rabbi Yossi Tzvi Rimon was, I think, here for lunch yesterday. Right? Was he here for lunch yesterday? Yeah. So I happened to, he also was at our Beit Midrash the day before, and I asked him this question. I asked him what he thought about the viruses, and he felt there was an added point that Rabbi Dalchovsky was omitting, which is, he said, you know, when you put a USB in your computer, often you get a prompt that asks you, do you want to check this? And he felt that that puts the onus on the individual user, because there is a prompt, and you should have checked it before using it. I will note, though, that that doesn't apply in all circumstances. First of all, there isn't always a prompt. Second, you can get it off of the network, and you know, you won't know at all. So I'm not so sure that that's true, that you'll necessarily be able to apply that. But
And your checker,
well, then the question is, are you responsible for keeping your checker up to date? But that's the principle, is, in terms of this second question, right, we dealt with the first question, the porter, and applied it to the carpal tunnel. In terms of the virus, Rabbi Dachovsky's understanding that it's like fire, and in fact one would be responsible, this is a form of harm, I think carries a lot of weight. I think it's an important point. But I want to come back to those two models. We began by saying that there are two models. One model is duty of care, and the other is trust. But there is a third model, which I want to just take a minute to discuss. And the third model comes from the Rambam in source number 13. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which says, Yihyu aniyim b'nei veisecha, which literally translates, paupers should be members of your household. Not that members of your household should be paupers, but that paupers should be members of your household. Which usually is understood to mean, invite needy people in. That's not the way the Rambam takes it. The Rambam writes in source number 13, Shera'ui sheyiyu mishamshecha hadalim v'ha'aniyim. He says, if you're going to get a servant, choose somebody who is poor and indigent, and that way you will give him a livelihood. Similarly, the Rambam writes, he talks about the eight levels of tzedakah, and the highest level of tzedakah is giving him a job, right? So that he'll be able to take care of himself. So there's another way to look at an employer-employee relationship, which is the employer is doing a kindness for the employee by providing him with a livelihood. And therefore, we don't want to overburden an employer. You don't want to create a situation in which people are not going to want to hire workers because they're afraid of liability. And that's a very real concern. So that there are responses dealing with questions of employer liability when something happens to a worker. And the Tzemach Tzedek, the first Tzemach Tzedek, not the one who's the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the one before him, there's a Tzemach Tzedek who was the second Rebbe, I think he was the second, and then there's also the Tzemach Tzedek who was before him, Rav Krochmal. And he deals with the question of employer liability, and he says you have to be very careful. He is really doing a mitzvah by hiring somebody, and therefore you'd want to be very careful about, you know, presenting liability for the employer. I think that's a third model. I think it needs to be looked at. It really requires its own discussion. I knew we wouldn't have time for it here, but I wanted to at least mention that as a concern. Yes, Chaim.
That third category would only really be if that type of employee you're hiring is relatively a commodity, where you can hire almost anybody who has that skill set. But if you're hiring someone who's more specialized, the employee is doing as much of a favor for the employer as the employer is doing for the employee.
Right. So that's really right. That's part of what has to be explored. What are the parameters here for saying this? Is it automatic? Anytime you're giving somebody else money, we assume that the employee is getting the better end of the deal? Or do we say that sometimes it's actually the kindness of the employee who is helping out. What about where it's a volunteer? Or it's mutual, right? This requires some discussion. It's not simple and straightforward, but I thought it was a fascinating other way to look at the connection. I want to make sure the source sheets are where. Not the source sheets, the sign-in sheets are where. Okay, so please, if you didn't sign in, I want to be able to notify you about future lunches. If you don't check off the box in the third column, you'll still get notification about lunches here and the classes going on here. I'll stick around for a few minutes to discuss. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. There's also another program that is happening.
Thank you.
Ethics. Two. Take them home. I'm on your fridge.